Welcome to the Pacific Group meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Duffy and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the newcomers. We're glad that you're with us tonight. The format of the meeting is as follows. We will read a portion of chapter 5, have two 10-minute speakers, read the 12 traditions, and our main speaker followed by birthdays. Thank you very much, dear. Speaker Aaron R.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I'm Erin, I'm an alcoholic. So I'll just get a few things out of the way. Thank you, Duffy, for asking me to do this. And it's an honor and a privilege to be able to share with again. Okay, can you hear me now? Do I need to start over?
You're good.
I do.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hi, I'm Erin. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Duffy, for... Did that cut into my time? Thank you, Duffy, for asking me to share. Wait, do I need to reset here? It's an honor and a privilege to share with my home group and apparently a lot of other people, too. Welcome. Welcome if you're new. Welcome to our group and to AA if you're getting sober during these times. Just stay close. Stay connected. Just a few things. Disclaimers. One, I have three children and they're kind of roaming around. So if I get distracted, don't mind them. And I have a sobriety date. It's February 13th of 2010. My sponsor is Mary Murphy and Pacific Group is my home group. So 10 minutes, I'll just go for it. I'm weird. I've always been weird. I've always felt weird at least. And I had reason to, I think as a young child, I was born into an ashram in Southern Indiana, which was awkward, you know, to live in a situation that was different from the other kids that I knew. And I was even awkward in the ashram that I lived in. Everyone would be downstairs at their, you know, vegetarian meal. And my dad, who actually taught Kundalini yoga and meditation my whole life, would be on the rooftop grilling ribeye steaks and drinking bottles of red wine and howling at the moon. So there was always this sort of strange dichotomy occurring in my life, a confusion, to say the least. And that's the alcoholic side of my family, my dad's side. And my mom's side is a very big Irish Catholic family, which actually doesn't have much alcoholism. In fact, they're kind of annoying. All 27 of us would gather for Easter dinner and they'd share a bottle of white Zinfandel, all of them. So my mom ended up leaving the ashram and taking me on some strange adventures. I lived in some islands in the South Pacific where I was the only white kid on the island, and I had to learn some skills like fighting, defending myself. And at a very young age, I also felt not a part of. And that's where I actually first started finding some solace in outside substances. I didn't have access to alcohol, but there was other substances on the island, strange things. This nut we would chew called betel nut, where you'd cut it in half, put a little white powder on it, wrap it in a cocoa leaf and a cigarette, a part of a cigarette, and you chew on it and spit out this orange juice. And I kind of ran around the island. That's how I actually made friends, by partaking in that substance, finally. And then we moved back to the States, and I was awkward moving back. I started drinking when I was 12. I really started drinking when I was 12. I took sips and here and there of alcohol and smoked some pot, but I really took off when I started drinking. I think my friends and I, we stole a bottle of Southern Comfort from the Hooks drugstore in Indiana, where my dad lived. And I woke up in the basement of some guy's house puking into a black trash bag. And he was probably trying to feel me up. And that's pretty much sums up my drinking. Didn't get much prettier than that, but I remember the effect that it produced, and it took away that awkwardness. It took away that weird, different feeling I had, and it didn't make me assimilate any better, but I definitely didn't care. I no longer cared at all about anyone's thinking. So I started to take off with my drinking. My mom had reestablished in San Diego, started a new family, and she wasn't able to handle my drinking throughout high school. So she asked me to leave when I was in high school. So I was on my own off and running and had some pretty good times. You know, I always had problems, but the alcohol was my solution. So the problems were all just relative, you know, the problems would pass. And I knew as soon as I got some substance in my body, I would be able to move on or change and do geographics. I wasn't under any parental supervision, but I stayed in high school. I played volleyball in high school and I became an emancipated minor and took care of myself. And I ended up in college. So that was good. I played volleyball in college. So I got an opportunity and I see that now in hindsight as being God taking care of me. But when I landed in Los Angeles after school, that's when I started to spiral the drain. So if you want to spiral the drain of alcoholism or drug addiction, LA is definitely the place to land. And I did. And I ended up at 27 years old, not knowing I had a problem because I had a solution. And waking up in Brotman Hospital with tubes down my throat and everyone that I knew that was left in my life standing over me wondering why I had done this. And I didn't know, you know, I just was having fun. And they actually took me back down to San Diego where my mom lived and checked me into the McDonald's center there where I actually checked in at a 0.36 blood alcohol level and took me about 12 days of DTs and to detox. And at that place, that was where I actually was introduced first to Alcoholics Anonymous from two guys who came in an H&I panel. And actually like to think of them as like those guys, Joe and Charlie, those big book thumpers that I used to listen to on speaker tapes. And they started to talk about the disease and read from the book and I identified and I ended up in treatment back here in Los Angeles for 30 days and then 6 months, a year of sober living. And I had pretty much lost everything, burned my life to the ground, which was good. But I quickly rebuilt my ego as a young newcomer in Los Angeles. AA is so attractive. You know, I fell in with like the fun crowd. I went to Rodeo and all these like shishi meetings on the West Side and I wasn't really sponsored. I wasn't working any steps. So after I met him and I got pregnant and we got married in that order. I had nothing to secure me in sobriety. So after I had my first child, I ended up relapsing again on my pain medication. And that was a whole nother spiral down on opiates and three kids later. And I had another one of those, you know, near death experiences from my disease because I just felt justified. You know, if you knew what was wrong with me, if you had to do what I did, if you were in my situation, then you would just leave me alone and let me be. You would let me have this peace of mind. It was the only peace of mind I could find. But it almost killed me again. I had this, you know, moment of clarity. It was, I call it my Elvis moment, actually. I was in the bathroom and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning and I had pictured myself dead on the floor and my kids finding me like that. And I told my husband what I had been doing and he took me to detox, which was another painful detox off of opiates. And I left AMA to get back to my kids. And I walked into the women's stag of Pacific Group the very next day. And I was in shock. There was too many women, too many teeth, too many lights. And I was a wreck. And I stayed in women's meetings my first year because I had three kids in tow and I was coming off this stuff really hard and my body wasn't right for a long time. And I really identify with women who have to deal with that because it's a tough one, you know, especially knowing I'm an alcoholic, but having to deal with this outside issue that was so justified. And I kind of forgot to set my timer. So if anyone wants to like give me a thumbs up or something, that would be great. So anyways, I how many? Okay. Yeah. So I ended up after a year. Perfect. So much to cover. 10 years of sobriety to cover in 2 minutes. So I ended up after a year of women's meetings coming into Pacific Group and really finding the accountability I need that changed my life. And I need identification with alcoholism. It's really important for an alcoholic like me to have that identification because I can very easily identify myself right out of the rooms with other people's problems. So this format, this accountability really worked for me. And I had found a couple of really wonderful women that sponsored me and landed in Mary Murphy's lap at 5 years and going through a divorce and having a really horrible time in my sobriety and not knowing if I could make it. And she absolutely shifted my sobriety and my life. And, you know, I have a wonderful relationship with my ex-husband and we parent our three kids with the help of our sponsors in this program. And I have a wonderful relationship with a man from this program that is so caring. And I've been able to, you know, take care of my kids and actually, you know, come out the other end. For someone who never went to the same school for longer than 2 years, I ended up becoming like really involved in their school and the PTA president. And then I ended up going back to school myself. I just actually finished my master's degree in yoga studies at Loyola Marymount, and I'm going on for some more postgraduate degree certification there. So my life has really taken a full turn, but I stay connected to my meetings. I stay connected to my group. I really do love all of you, and I miss all of you. I have one kid sneaking in the door. I have one kid calling me on the phone. I think my time is up. I think I gave everyone enough juice. But I'm really grateful for my sobriety. And I just want to say real quick too, I absolutely love my sobriety. Okay. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Erin. Thank you very much. That's great. Our next speaker tonight is Sean C. Yay. We cannot hear you, Sean. Let's see. Cannot hear you yet.
Sean, your audio is not connected. I can see your microphone is on and unmuted, but your audio is not connected right now. Let's see. Maybe unplug your headset.
There.
Can we hear you, Sean? Say something, Shawnee.
No, I can't hear him.
His microphone shows that he's on, Duffy.
It does,
but I don't hear a word he says. Sean, check your Zoom settings and just make sure your microphone's turned on in your Zoom. You have the right microphone.
And in the meantime, nope. You keep
try to unplug your headset.
Nope. Can you hear us? Give us a thumbs up if you can hear us. You can hear us. Okay. You just can't. We can't hear you at all, but your microphone shows us on. And we're capped at 1,000, so you can't exit and rejoin.
Okay. Sean, I don't know what to tell you, but I love you very much, and I love you. I'm going to surprise somebody, and I'm going to call on Brian Adley. Are you able to join us, Brian, and give us a 10-minute talk? Yeah, there we go.
Oh, boy. My name's Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Brian.
Okay, so... yeah, boy, I need this like a hole in the head. Well, thank you. Thank you, Duffy. Sorry, Sean. Sean was going to give you the best 10-minute talk you've ever heard. And you can see he looked fabulous, too. I'm totally unprepared. It's really weird talking to 1,000 people that you can't see and you get no reaction from. But the most important thing I can tell you is that I'm an alcoholic. And if you're new, I really want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. This version, the live version, the touchy-feely version, all the versions. And I tell you that I have a life today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for those of you who are not regularly part of our group but have come in from all over, really the world, you know, welcome to you as well. We're really glad to have you. And you get to see or share a bit of what we have here in Pacific Group, which is old-fashioned Alcoholics Anonymous. And you see my beautiful wife is with me here today. And so at any rate, I started out in Canada, like Sean started out in Canada. And my father was Royal Canadian Air Force, by the way, belated Happy Memorial Day to all veterans and all those who served. And I grew up in the frozen north of Canada. I mean, really frozen, very north of Canada. And I have three older sisters, and I come from a family of professional non-feelers and non-emoters. We're military, we're Canadian, we're Protestant. We don't talk about anything, and that's just how it rolls. And so when I started to drink, I actually drank to remember more than to drink to forget. I drank to feel emotions. At the age of 14, my father quit the Air Force. Well, he didn't quit. He retired from the Air Force, and we moved to Los Angeles, and I got moved into the middle of the Canoga Park barrio. And I learned to run to school every day and run home every day. And I was really a fish out of water. And in 10th grade, somebody asked me if I wanted to get high. And I'd never thought about getting high, but I had become political, and I knew it should be legalized. And 50 years later, I'm correct. But at the time, in 1969, it wasn't a big thing. And so I got high and on weed, and my first, you know, year, I liked all those other things, all those outside issues, because I didn't want to drink because my mother was an alcoholic, and alcohol was for old people, it seemed to me, and I just didn't want to do it. And so I tended towards amphetamines because I'm a naturally nervous and intense person, and I like to jack that up an extra notch, you know. And then so I was at a party one day, and somebody gave me a glass of Wild Turkey, and alcohol became, as Charlie C likes to say, my drug of no choice. I liked all those other things. They were a lot of fun, but alcohol does something that those things don't do. And that makes me not care about what you think about me or what I think about me. And I am always thinking about what you're thinking about me, especially I'm worried right now about what 1,000 people are thinking about me. And when I drink, I don't care. I mean, and that's the sweetest relief I've ever known in my life. The only other way you can get that relief other than drinking is to be helping another alcoholic or doing a really excellent, fine thing for other people. And that is a lot of work, and it doesn't happen all the time. So alcohol is just a great shortcut to that. And so I got a timer here. I'm a daily drunk. I see no purpose in waiting to drink. I see no purpose in waiting till the evening to drink, let alone waiting for another day. The trouble with being a daily drunk is you don't have an exciting life. You have a mundane, I just need to get drunk every day life. I went through a number of marriages. I am the common denominator of every bad relationship I've ever had. That's all I can tell you. I'm an alcoholic. I will suck everything you have out of you and then explain to you that it is you are the problem, except this one. And you know, you can't have a real relationship with another human being that way. You know, but I'm a black hole of emotional need. I think that's very typical of a lot of alcoholics. I went through one marriage, an interracial marriage to an Irish girl, and then I got married again years later, and finally I had a child, and at 2 years into that marriage, everything fell apart. You know, I was a daily drunk, and things were bad, and I used to say that I got sober to save that marriage, but that's not true. I am willing to throw a marriage onto the bonfire of my alcoholism. You can get another wife. They're out there, you know. But I had known guys that, you know, I was not a good father, but I was a proud father. And I'd show pictures of my son, you know, my baby son, to guys in bars, and say, here's my beautiful boy. And they'd say, I have a kid, but I haven't seen him in 10 years or 12 years. And I knew that if I had kept drinking, that eventually I wouldn't see that kid. And I don't mind failing, but I didn't want to fail at that, you know. And so that's really the reason I got sober. I just didn't want to be that guy. You know, my first 4 years of sobriety, I went to one or two meetings a week, came late, left early, hung out in the back, made a lot of noise. I know there's a God because I stayed sober with absolutely no worthwhile program my first 4 years of sobriety. Because it wasn't me keeping me sober, I'll tell you that much. After 4 years of sobriety, you know, I just hit a wall. I was about to get divorced. And my ex-wife had been sponsored by Betty Ann Z. And they asked if we would meet with Betty Ann and Bob before we got divorced. And so we met with Betty Ann and Bob. And as Bob likes to say, he told us how the hogs ate Little Willie and explained how this program really needs to work in my life. And I became willing. And instead, you know, and what that amounted to was coming to the Pacific Group, going to four or five meetings a week, starting to sponsoring guys, playing at the yard. And if you go from a do-nothing program to a busy, active life in Alcoholics Anonymous, your life will get better. Whether you want it to or not, you really have no control over that. It just gets better. And at 13 years of sobriety, after lip-syncing about a lot of things in the program, I asked the late Clint Hodges, to take me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and through the steps. And it absolutely changed my life. I'm not going to give you a step talk. I will tell you this. If you haven't taken the steps, what I got out of it was an absolute understanding that there is a God and that I am always going to be okay. And that set me up for the rest of my life, you know. I went through a lot of ups and downs in my sobriety, and eventually that marriage of 27 years ended. And every, you know, I've seen a lot of bad divorces in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. But everything I ever learned in this program and everything she had ever learned in Al-Anon came together in one moment. And we sat down, and in 5 minutes we had figured it all out without any lawyers. And we're good friends today. And then I was pretty sure I was just going to spend the rest of my life holed up in a room crying every Friday night, you know, out of sheer loneliness. But I am an Alcoholics Anonymous, and life goes on. And one night, thanking the speaker at the Monday night Encino meeting, I met this beautiful woman here. And which is, so guys, just saying, you know, if you really thank that speaker. You know, and she had 3 years sober. So to me, she still smelled of alcohol. I had 27 years at the time. And so, but I called her sponsor, who was Carla, the wonderful Carla, and asked if she was ready for a relationship. I asked permission to court Sarah and asked if she was ready for a relationship. And Carla said, yes, she is. Her sobriety, because I don't need to threaten anybody's society. You know, that was 8 years ago. We've been married the last 5 years. We have a sober, happy home in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Duffy, thanks for scaring the hell out of me. And wish you all a good night. And can't wait to give you, you know, hold you all in our arms again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Brian. Thank you. That was great. You jumped in well. Okay. Yay, Larry.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you're good to go, Larry.
Okay. Everybody, my name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Duffy for going out on the limb and having me come and be with you guys. I'm a proud member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's absolutely an honor and a privilege to be out with you guys tonight. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for a little over 38 years and not amount to a damn thing. So I'm here to give Brian some hope. I've got a good life today. My wife is in the other room. I asked her if she would like to listen to the meeting, and she said she'd rather clean her closet. And I totally understand that. I'm a loser. I'm a hostile loser. And when you're a loser like me, you grow up your entire life, just ducking and dodging and signing up for the minimum, you know. And I come from good people, you know. I You know, I was born in Detroit and come out to California when I was about 6 years old, 5 years old, something like that. And while I was in Detroit, my folks didn't get along well and none of that stuff. And so they put me in a little orphanage over there. And then they got together and my dad moved out to California first, and then they came and got me. And, you know, they both grew up in the, you know, the ghettos and the streets of Detroit, and they had a tough life, you know. And my mom was a little Scandinavian lady, and she liked diet pills. So my mom was always, she was always up. No matter what time you got up, she was up doing something. She was vacuuming, waxing, cleaning, and doing all kinds of stuff. And no matter what time you got up, she was up. So you always had somebody to talk to. My dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a World War II vet. And I want to thank all the people on this meeting who served our country. And my dad was a World War II vet. And he grew up in the streets of Detroit. And he was a hardworking guy. And he always used to tell me, you don't know how good you got it. You don't know how good you got it. Back when I was your age, we really had it tough. And make no mistake, he did. He had a heck of a life. And, you know, his father died when he was about 13, choked on himself. And his mother hung herself in a Detroit jail. She was a drunken whore. And his dream was to marry my mom and live that good life that they read about. And you know, have a family and stuff, live in California, you know. My dad was a happy drunk. His drinking didn't scare me, you know. I mean, you know, all through school and stuff, you know, when you read your little books, you know, alcohol, they got skull and crossbones and stuff like that. And, you know, don't smoke marijuana, you know, you get hooked on heroin in a year, you know, that's a lie. Takes 2 months, you know, and he, you know, we used alcohol for everything in that house. If you got a cut, I had some kind of fever. I was always losing my appetite. My mom would heat up some wine or something like that. And if you got a cut, it was a remedy for everything. And my dad, he was a refinery worker. So he was always working different hours you know, he would start drinking, and, you know, he was a happy singing the blues, Nat King Cole, Bobby Darin drunk, man. He loved to get drunk and sneak into his own home. It was an amazing thing. And, you know, one night he snuck in my window. That big boot came down on my bedroom. I grabbed that boot and I said, hey, Pop, I said, you know, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys? You know, my God, she's up anyway. You know, I can hear the Hoover going now, you know. But his drinking never scared me, because I could see the change in that man. I knew he found something, and that's what caught my attention. You know, when you're, you know, on the look at that age I was, you know, I mean, I was on the look for something. I knew I was lost. I was a curious little kid, you know. I was stealing and running away from home. I didn't feel a part of that home. I didn't trust my folks, you know. They would be telling you to do stuff and they wouldn't do it myself, and that would confuse me, you know. So just had this god-awful feeling, you know. And at an early age, I just wanted to feel different than what I was feeling on my own, you know. Always fighting to feel good, you know. And so at around 11 years old, I mean, things were going good till I was about 9, and I was good in sports, and I had little girlfriends and buddies and stuff like that. But, you know, I was afraid to sleep at night, because I knew that's when God was going to get me. You know, he got my little brother. You know, my little brother was 5, and, you know, he died, at, you know, when my mom was having him. And I thought, my God, nobody explained that to me. So I knew that, you know, what kind of God would, you know, create a baby and kill it, he's coming after me next. And so I was going to wait up for him, you know. And just all these goofy ideas about life and stuff, and afraid to ask people about him, you know. I was a disappointment to my mom and dad, I knew. my mom was a discourager. I would ask her about building tree forts and, you know, going body surf. No, 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 you're gonna hurt yourself. And I got the idea. I knew I wasn't a man enough for the job, you know what I mean? And that wasn't her thought at all. By taking an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous, she was just afraid to lose her other son. So she was pretty protected of me. My dad, on the other hand, man, he just, he did what fathers do, and they wanted the best for his son. And I remember my old man, when I turned 13, he gave me this piece of paper, and on that piece of paper, he wrote, "Now that you're a young man," and he wrote down about the things I should be looking to do, and goals in school, and thinking about my career and stuff like that. And I looked at that stuff, man, and I damn near laughed in his face, and I threw it away. I knew, see, I've got this vanity about me that not only do I gotta look good, but so do the people around me. And my old man's a refinery worker. He's got a helmet on, you know, and he's got glasses on, and he's got a steel lunch bucket, and he's got a pencil holder, and he's got these refinery boots. And I looked at him and I thought, oh, no, you don't, man. If that's what your hard work got you, I don't want nothing about that. I don't have nothing about that, you know. I'm looking at the guys down the street over there in a dog patch in Torrance, and I'm seeing that they may be a couple years older than me, and their hair slicked back, you know, and they got their t-shirts on and their black Frisco pants. And I said, now that's what I need to be, you know what I mean? And at 11 years old, there was four of us in the garage, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, man, a little nobody felt like a somebody. You know what I mean? A little nobody that no matter what I did and how good I did it, I always felt like a little nobody. But I took a shot of Four Rose whiskey, and it made a nobody a somebody just for a couple hours. And to a nobody, that's top of the world. And I never laughed so hard that I did that day. I never threw up so much as I did that day. And I remember that evening, I kissed my first Latin woman. And it was my aunt. She was 46 years old, and I went after my little auntie Della, you know. And that next morning, I didn't, lose my paper out and go to the Alano Club and join AA, you know. But I did mark that spot. Now, my dad, whenever I would do something wrong, there was no problem with him teaching me a lesson. There was no, I knew when I came home that night, I knew I was going to get it. I banked on it, you know, and I snuck in that house and I snuck in that bedroom and I went to sleep, and that old bed took around like a damn flying saucer, you know, and I woke up, and that next morning I knew, man, you are in for it. That old man's going to light you up. And I poked my head out that window, you know, see where he was, and couldn't find him. First thing that I seen was my dad's bar. My dad made a bar, and it only fit one guy, you know, and he had all the stuff in there, and he put a lock and a door on it because he knew what was in that room, you know what I mean? And I made a right turn, and I had no regrets. I had no regrets, man, you know. I never want to forget what it was like to be about 18 years old. I read in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, last week in our book study, is he not a self-seeker even when he's kind? Boy, you know, that's the only reason I'm kind, is I'm seeking something. But isn't that the truth, that no matter what I'm doing, man, I'm self-seeking. It's about me, you know? And I never want to forget what it was like to be 17, 18 years old, and I was put away for a small period of time, and I came back. They dropped the bus off at the courtyard, and we were supposed to go in there, and I get off, and I run into the neighborhood, and it's a Monday, and I come out on the Thursday. And I don't show up at the probation department. I don't show up anywhere. What I do show up is at 8 o'clock in the morning with that rain. I showed up at my mom's place of business. She's working at a dry cleaner's during the week, and she's cleaning people's houses on the weekend. And I make fun of her, and I'm ashamed of her. But I'm not too ashamed to show up unannounced at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'm standing in this parking lot, and her little dry cleaners is about 50 yards away, and there's all these cars before you get to her door, and I'm hiding behind this parked car, waiting for that last customer to come out. so I could walk through that rain as if it was yesterday. I see myself with my dirt and my filth and my bare feet and, as Wino Joe used to call, the habiliments of despair. And I'm walking through there and I open up that door to her dry cleaners and that brass bell hits that window. And she turns around and she makes that oh so familiar sound. She goes, oh my God, Larry, where you been? You know, and she grabs her little wallet and she pulls out $2 or $3, $4. And I just grab that money and I run off to Wilmington where I'm going to die. Now, the thing that brings it home to me tonight in our little meeting, which I am so glad I'm here, is that you take this same man, new in Alcoholics Anonymous, with my so-called desperation, willing to go to any length, and I need to ask you something. How come when my life depends on it, I can't ask Duffy for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life and put her that same distance as me and my mom? I can't walk that same distance and ask Duffy for a job in a meeting that's going to save my life, and make no mistake, these commitments will. But I can walk that distance and use my mom and folks like her time and time and time again. And I'm here to share with you if you're new. And this is the only thing that I have decent in my life is my past. My past is my greatest memory. My past is my greatest asset. And I need to tell you something. That how come I can't walk that same distance and get that job in a meeting, but I can use my mom time and time and folks like her time and time again. I'm here to share with you if you're new that if my alcoholism doesn't kill me, my selfishness and my self-centeredness will, make no mistake about that. Which is why it's necessary for a man with 38 years to have a job and a routine of meetings in my home group and every group that I attend. And I have these commitments in these meetings for one reason, and one reason only if you're new. I will never get so sober that I can't get drunk again. But I can get so drunk that I can't make it back. And I never want to forget what I used to be like. I never want to forget what's happened to me and what I'm like today. I never want to forget from the time I was 13 to the time I was 30, I found myself sitting in rooms from the state, from the county, from hospitals, from churches, with people sitting across from me with little diplomas and literature trying to talk me into being an alcoholic. They had the proof, they had the evidence, they had pictures of my fat feet and my liver, they had all this literature. And I was always sitting in these rooms with people trying to almost convince me that I'm an alcoholic. And I am so glad today that they weren't able to do that. I am so glad that you can't talk somebody into this, because they would be robbing me of the most divining moment of my life, where for the first time in my life, I concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. When you are humbled at that level, you become willing to do things that you can't imagine to do just to save your life. Only because there just isn't any ideas to go. Nobody talks to you to that point. You live your way there. You drink yourself there. You know, my saving grace, the thing that made me May 2nd, 1982, the thing that saved my life, and I never want to forget this, was that when I was 2 months sober, I was taken to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the man that I was with took me to a speaker meeting, and he couldn't wait for me to go to this speaker meeting. And in that meeting, there was a guy standing up at this Alano Club with a powder blue suit and a cigarette holder, middle-aged man with big horn-rimmed glasses. And he was up there and he started waving his hands. And he said the simple words. He says, If your problem is alcohol, you're not an alcoholic. And he says, if and then when you get sober, you can't stay sober, and sobriety seems to be your problem, you may be suffering from alcoholism. In something like that, he talked about the disease of perception, and he saved my life. He saved me, if you don't drink, everything will be all right. And I don't drink, and I go absolutely mad when I stop drinking, become restless, irritable, discontented, you know? And, you know, with, and just driven to drink because I the insanity, that the obsession is not removed, you know? And like I said, around 19, you know, if I can find that thing that keeps me from serving you, I will have found the key to life, you know? And I didn't know that then. But I hook up with these lowriders and I head out to, I thought maybe I'd grab my buddy and go to Detroit. You know, I'll bounce off to Detroit, you know, and get my life together. And that's one thing, if you're new, that's happened to me since I got sober, is I haven't had to start over again. I haven't, my life seemed to be a series of just starting over. New town, new probation officer, you know, new little job. Everything's good for about 2 months, you know, and then I'm off and running again, you know. And I head out to Detroit to find my roots, you know, and I wound up in Phoenix. I wound up in Phoenix and North Central and Roosevelt, and worked for a couple plumbers there. And, you know, I got arrested for stealing. And, you know, I mean, that's one thing I like to do, is be in your house, whether it's under it or in the attic. And, you know, I got in trouble doing that. And then I got another job with a plumber out there, and I worked for the guy for about 2 weeks. And I found out that he was younger than me. And I thought, oh, man, I ain't working for no kid. So I did what I, you know, I always did, you know, what any honorable man would do. I faked a knee injury. And they took me to the county hospital. And the doctor wrote me a prescription for Percodan. And then he left the office and left me a cardboard box full of blank prescription pads he wanted me to have. So I, geez, I grabbed that thing, man, went running down North Central in Phoenix, and I ducked into the old Wagon Wheel Bar, and this little guy I know named Ernie, and Ernie says, you know, he made some phone calls to some guys in Yuma, Arizona, and, you know, we started writing prescriptions, and, you know, writing prescriptions for everything, Seconal, Tuenol, Nembutal, you name it all, we wrote it all, you know, and damn near took it all, too, and after about 9 months, they caught up with me, and when you're loaded on whiskey and barbiturates, there's no freeway chase, you know. You know, I was going 9 miles an hour, you know, and the cop was on foot. He was just, you know, hey, hold down that window, kid, you know. And I'm thinking, my God, can this guy run, you know? He whipped me out of that car, threw me in jail, arrested me. I was there for about a year, got out of there. 1973, they put me on the bus back to California, go to the probation department. And 1973, they put me on Anabuse. And they didn't take me to no AA or nothing. They just gave me a voucher for a little hotel in downtown Torrance and put me on Anabuse. And after about 2 months, I had a little job interview to a refinery where I'm going to be a part-time janitor at night. And I'm not going to drive till I'm 32, so I'm always taking buses all over the place. And so I get there about 3 hours early in this little town of El Segundo, and I'm walking around this little town go into this little league dugout. I remember this, you know, and I sit on that little dugout and I think about me and my dad, and I think about how all the times we played catch together and stuff like that, and how he wanted me to be a ball player and stuff like that. And I start crying, and I cried for a while, and then I started laughing for a while, and I started crying for a while. And this went on for a couple hours, and this paranoia that usually floats around me gets pretty intense, and it sticks, and these hallucinations come about me that usually are floating and gone, and these little guys stick. And the guy that picked me up from the paramedics had become somewhat catatonic, and they picked me up wandering around in a place, and they took me to the Harbor General Hospital, and I'm in this emergency room on a gurney, and I got an arm and a leg strapped down, and the doctor came up to me with a little piece of paper, and he said, it seems, by the way you've been living for the past several years, he says, I think we're going to take you to a mental facility where you can be observed for about 30 or 60 days. And they sent me, you know, over the hill and to Oxnard and to this little mental place, and where I was going to stay for 30 or 60 days. And a year later, they let me out, you know, and they gave me all the medication that they promised me that would help me with my they were sure that the problems that I had with my past, and they would transfer me to this new Dr. Joe Scales of Camarillo's opened up this residential place for tryouts in over there in Gardena, 135th in Vermont, and they sent about 12 of us over there, and they put me on certain medications, and after a while I got out of there, and after 2 months I ran out of Thorazine, and in 1975 they found me over there on Alvaro Street, across the street at the Chevron gas station, on a pile of tires. And I wasn't over there vaping. I was over there trying to rest. Because at that time in my life, there is no invisible line. There is nothing people don't do to get a drink. There is no, oh, I can't do that. And I'm living a life, I introduced my mom and dad to a level of living they didn't know existed. And insisted on rubbing their face into it. And they arrested me on a public nuisance and out-of-state forgeries. And they put me up to the county jail in the Wayside. And I'm going to be sentenced to 3.5 years in a state penitentiary. And after a couple months, they put about 50 of us in a black and white bus and sent us to the South Bay Courthouse. And I'm in a holding tank about the size of an average garage. And there's about 40 of us in there. And one by one, the judge is calling all these guys out. And none of them are coming back. They're getting released and stuff. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm the only one left. I'm on a concrete floor with a bombs bag and no hope, wondering where they're going to send me now. Where are we going now? And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a Scottish man with a patch rolled open that jail door. And he stood there clean and shiny, just like Ebby did to Bill. And he had a patch over his eye. And he goes, "Aye, lad." He says, "Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He says, "That's great." He says, "Come with me, son. We're going to AA." And I thought, oh my God, what's AA, you know? Who's the Scottish pirate all of a sudden, you know? I've heard of OR and PO, but, you know, what's this AA stuff? And who's, you know, who is this guy? And looking back well over 40 years, well over 45 years, I know exactly who that man is. Because my life is sprinkled with him. Two for sure. My life is sprinkled with what this guy was. And there's some of them on this meeting tonight. It's what my book calls a trusted servant. And what would make that man a trusted servant was simply this. He had no business of being there. He wasn't a probation officer. He wasn't a counselor. He was a refinery worker who just got the worst news of his life. And that news was that his wife was dying immediately. And he knew she was in good hands, but he knew he wasn't. You see, but somewhere in his meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, somewhere in his meeting, a Monday night meeting in Bellflower, somewhere in his meeting on a Wednesday night meeting in Brentwood, somewhere in his 12 and 12 in Long Beach, California, that man was to sit with you folks and grasp and develop a manner of living that ingrained in him this, that practical experience tells us that nothing can ensure immunity from drinking, but intensive work with other alcoholics. This works. He didn't think of milk and whiskey. It had been removed, just as it did with Bill laying on the town's hospital when Ebby came with those proposals. Bill didn't just lay there and have this happen. Ebby took him through these proposals, and Bill had this profound experience. And for years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a frustrated man for at least 5 or 6, because I thought that's what was supposed to happen to me, and it wasn't. I didn't get it after the third step, and I wasn't getting it after the, maybe I was doing something wrong. And I would sit with you folks in that book study, and I would read that Bill story, and I would see that 2 paragraphs after Bill's laying in that bed where he had the experience, 2 paragraphs down, laying in that same pea-stained bed, Bill had the thought that maybe I should work with other alcoholics. He didn't think that maybe I should work with everyone. Maybe I should work with, how many of you guys on your first day sober had that thought? That's how rare it is. And two paragraphs down, maybe I should, and I thought, my God, maybe, just maybe, the thing that happened to Bill suddenly, he's hoping will happen to me gradually, but the end game is the same. We're looking for other alcoholics. There is one answer to all problems. Trust God, clean house, and work with others. And I am so glad that I read that. I am so glad that I've experienced that, because you can't talk people into doing things. Eventually, they're going to get frustrated if they don't not inspired to do. That's what my problem was. I used to think desperation would keep me sober. And what would happen is that desperation would wear off and I was off and running. And you folks taught me that I got to replace that desperation with inspiration. And then even then, it's not enough, because then you need to perpetuate it. I had no idea what was the sort of me. And that man took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975, threw me into this little Chevrolet. And in the car, he told me, son, I know you've had a tough life and you feel different. But he says, I can't wait for you to meet these people. And if you're new, I can't wait for you to meet these people. I can't wait for you to be with us. And I know it may seem odd, and I know you may seem out of sorts, and I know you may seem like it's the wrong group or whatever you, but I know you got a head that doesn't want you to be here. But if you can reverse that thrust and all that energy you put into not wanting to be here, if you can go ahead and just do what somebody tells you to do in this group anyway, you will not regret it. You will not. Don't let your head have power over you, man. Let us have you for a little bit. Let us have you while we take you through us on these steps and stuff like that until you become inspired. And you will not regret it if you're new, you know. Find out. There is nothing more powerful if you're new. I beg you to find that book. Find that book and find a part of you in that book. Find a man that'll take you to these meetings. Call him your sponsor and love him. And then find that man in that book and see a fellowship that's expressed itself in that book. And reap the benefits of that book. And I'll tell you something, if you're new, there's nothing to get in AA. There's nothing to get here. If you come here to get something, you're going to be frustrated and leave. The only thing you're going to get in AA is be prepared to be divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your damn life. You'll have to do the uncomfortable to get comfortable. It's an amazing thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that you take that desire to run out and reverse the thrust and put it into staying with us, man. Put all your energy into staying with us, and you will not have any regrets. I love my sponsor to death. I love my grand sponsor to death. And there's not a thing that I ever regret about being with the people at the Wednesday night meeting. I miss the moments. I don't miss the speaker. I miss the moments. I miss the little moments at the 7:15 gathering I have with Mickey and Tim and John. I miss the moments of when I'm in that coffee crew. My coffee crew people, I love to death and I miss them. But I know I'm going to see them again. I know I'm going to see them again. This little deal is nothing more than another commitment for me. That's it. I'm just going to do it for a couple more months. But the main thing is I get to see you. Whether I see you on a Zoom or I see you in an alley, something happens to me when I'm with you. And I call that a power greater than myself. I'm playing in the evidence, man. I am playing in the evidence of a power greater than myself. Because on a Wednesday night, I'm looking at a goddamn filthy computer that I've never known who it is. And I see row after row after row of people who should be locked up, dead, or insane. And look at us tonight. We're happy, we're joyous, and we're free. And by golly, we're together. And I want to revisit that window. Thanks a lot, folks.
Thank you very much, Larry. Thank you very much. We're going to unmute all so everybody can thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
At the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cake. If you wish to participate in this custom, please send through Venmo a mail or mail a check, and please make note that it is for the birthday donation. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contributions to AA organizations worldwide. We'll put that email address in the chat box now. Thank you. Tonight, we are celebrating the following birthdays. Our first birthday tonight, excuse me, is for 13 years for Rick A. Happy birthday, Rick. We're glad you're having a birthday. Our next birthday is for 30 years for Richard C. Happy birthday, Richard. Our next birthday for 30 years again is for Roger A. Happy birthday, Roger. Our next birthday is for 31 years for Lydian T. Happy birthday, Lydian. Our next birthday for 33 years is for Jeremy J. Happy birthday, Jeremy. Our next birthday is for 35 years for Norma J. Happy birthday, Norma. Another 35 years for Carol T. Happy birthday. Our next birthday for past secretary for 49 years, Nancy M. Happy birthday, Nancy. And our last birthday of the evening is for 53 years for Marlena B. Happy birthday, Marlena. That is 9 birthdays for a total of 309 years with an average of 34. Special